Hello and welcome to In Focus with Insight. My name is Pamela Hillig. I'm head of Insight Life Solutions, and this is an episode of the Open Book series in which we get to know fascinating and inspiring people in the insurance and actuarial community through the books that they have read and loved. This is our last episode of 2024, and to celebrate, I'm privileged to be joined by the Group CEO of Insight, Barry Childs. Welcome, Barry.
Thanks for having me, Pam.
Is this your first time on the
Yes.
podcast? Welcome. Nice to have you.
Happy to be here.
So this is a podcast in which we get to know you and the things you're busy with and what you're passionate about. But what makes it a bit different is that we have an added angle of the books that have shaped you in some way. So you can think of it as the Desert Island Discs for bibliophiles.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Happy, happy.
So Barry, tell me, are you a reader?
I'm a reader. Not as much as I would like, and it comes in fits and starts, but yes, I'd like to claim being a reader.
Okay, so to get today started, because it's a bit of a summer episode and make it a bit fun, I'm going to ask you some quick fire questions about your reading habits.
Happy.
Kindle, physical, audiobooks.
Combination of physical books and audiobooks.
Do you DNF books if you don't enjoy them?
Yes, but I struggle. So it's like a hard decision. I have to grapple with the decision, but then yeah, sometimes I let one go.
Okay. How many books have you read this year?
Including audio.
Yes. Bands of
I'd
10.
yeah, I would maybe say 50,
Oh, wow.
40.
That's good going. Yeah.
Yeah, the audio helps a lot.
Okay. Do you listen while you drive?
While I drive, while I travel. Sometimes while I'm exercising, depending on the kind of exercise. So, yeah, I mean, in a given week, it'll be 25 hours of listening easy.
Okay.
Yeah, 20 hours, yeah.
Do you judge a book by its cover?
No, but that's a weird dilemma for me, actually, because, like, if you just walk into a bookstore randomly without knowing what you're looking for, other than reading the abstract on every book, well, you need something to attract your attention.
Yeah.
And then some of the bookstores only show the spines. It's a struggle.
So where do you get your recommendations from?
Sometimes from people I know that have, let's say overlapping themes of interest. So sci-fi or fantasy genre might say, well, I know you like that and I read this and we can swap. And then sometimes you find, that you haven't come across like a series of books that someone else has read that you really enjoy, and that sets you down that pathway. Sometimes the Goodreads algorithms or Audible algorithms, will put up something interesting, and then you have to decide whether to try something new or carry on in a series. And sometimes you're just some exploration, looking for things, like, searching for a good new series if I've finished a series. I like a series.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we'll talk about that today. So you use the Goodreads app?
Like off and on, not especially. If it's something new and I'm not sure about, I might go and have a look and see what the ratings are, what some of the comments are.
Okay. And who do you discuss books with, if anyone?
It's not a big circle, Dan. I think it's a weird. I mean, in the sort of business sense, there'll be particular books I would recommend to people, or there might be a theme that comes up in conversation that I'll say, "Oh, have you read this book or that book?" But then I tend to have like non-overlapping circles. Like some of the books I like, certain people will like, and that might come up in conversation. And then other books like are not interesting to them at all, and vice versa. So it just depends. And some people don't read. So then you don't talk about books at all.
Yeah, non-readers hate talking about books or
Yeah, it's
hate
like
reading.
weird. How could you
Yeah.
waste your time doing that?
Yeah. It's like listening to people talk about sport.
Something like that, yeah.
Do you sniff books?
I don't know what that is. Like, literally.
Yeah. No.
No. No, I don't do that.
Okay.
I'm sure maybe that's a thing. I don't do
Yeah, neither do I.
that.
Who do you say is your favorite character in literature?
Wow, that's a great question. It's hard not to go with the iconic characters, actually.
There's a
The
reason
sort
they're
of,
iconic.
the Gandalfs of the world from Lord of the Rings, probably those kind of characters. Hard not to go with one of those.
What's your favorite book to movie adaptation?
Blade Runner, probably.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a little obscure.
Who
Yeah.
wrote Blade Runner?
Actually, I would say, let me, can I recant? Can I? I would probably say the current Dune movies are, I
Okay.
think, the extraordinary adaptations of the books.
What's your favorite bookshop in the world?
Any bookshop where I can find the branded Moleskine notebooks, which are like
Okay.
a vice for me. There's a beautiful, beautiful bookshop in Maastricht in Netherlands, where my daughter's studying. That's like a chapel with the stained glass. It's not a lot of English books there,
Oh,
unfortunately, but it's nice to walk around.
wow.
But I'm not fussy. I'll walk into any bookshop, secondhand bookshops. There's a really nice bookshop at Peregrine. That's a bit of an undiscovered thing for a lot of people. Peregrine Farm Stall
Okay.
on the way to Elgin. But yeah, wherever. Bargain Books, Wordsworth exclusive. I'm not really fussy.
Do you annotate your books?
No, not really. Maybe a dog ear on something I might want to come back
Okay.
to, but not really annotated.
Okay, and what's the last book that made you laugh out loud?
Busy reading a series of books by Robert Galbraith, who is J.K. Rowling's pseudonym of a detective in London, and they're quite heavy and dark, but the writing is extraordinarily good, and there's some humor thrown in there, which yeah has caused me to laugh a couple of times.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that was going to be my last question, but I have another one. If you were to write a book, what genre would it
That's
be?
a great question. It also sits in the back of my head all the time. I think you're also a aspiring writer. I wouldn't even say I'm aspiring. I'm like a wannabe. If I had to choose to be successful in one thing, it would have been to write an amazing book, you know?
Yeah.
It's not so easy as it turns out. What genre?
What topic or subject? Whatever you've thought about.
I don't know. So about, it could be many things. I mean, it would probably be fiction, because I'm not sure anybody would want to hear from me on non-fiction things. But probably be fiction, and probably be in one of the genres I like, which are like international spy things or sci-fi or fantasy. One of those. Hard to say. Don't know where to get started. Maybe that's the problem.
Thank you. That. I have more, but I'll spare you. How would you sum up 2024?
It's been a wild ride of a year in at every level you could think of. I think at a global level, like sea changes in politics and chaos and wars and volatility, in the actuarial sense. Locally similar, we had a wild ride politically, economically, etc. One level down for me would be insight, which takes up the bulk of my time, and that's been also a crazy ride for us. Like lots of growth, lots of excitement, lots of new things. Running a business is not without its challenges, but overwhelmingly positive experience. This is our 10th year, so we're celebrating Insight's 10th year of existence this year, which is also very exciting. And yeah, other personally, been a great year. Family are great. Yeah, I can't complain.
Okay, good. And what are the things keeping you busy at the moment?
Yeah, what's keeping me busy is Insight has grown into a meaningful employer, a meaningful business. We're at about 100 people now, and lots of moving parts, that need attention, different things every day, which is what makes it exciting. Lots of opportunities everywhere I look, there's opportunities. And my main problem is what they taught me in Economics One, which is opportunity cost and having to make trade-offs and decisions, which I would just like to do like 10 things all at the same time, but it's difficult to do that. That keeps me busy, day to day, looking after each of the divisions, or not looking after, but getting involved where I'm needed in each of the divisions. And yeah, my kids are sort of late teenage. My eldest one is, well, she's 20, turning 21, so she's studying overseas. That requires a certain amount of attention. Second is 17, going into matric, so that takes a certain amount of attention. And my youngest is 15, going into the subject choice year, so that requires a certain
Gosh.
amount of attention. So yeah, it's a lot trying to stay healthy and fit along the way. It's a lot.
Are any of them budding actuaries in your children?
No. I was going to say, fortunately, unfortunately, I don't know which is the call, but
Yeah.
yeah, they've not leaned that way.
Okay. What's the first book we're going to talk about today?
So I want to break with your tradition, Pam, if you don't mind.
Oh,
I'm sorry. So yeah, I
let's
came
go with
with
it.
I much prefer, as opposed to a list of books, I'd prefer a list of authors because, as I hinted at earlier, I like a series, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. Like I try to, if I find a fiction book, there's got to be like three or four that I, you know, will spend time on. Maybe even, you know, one a year. In some of these series, these characters go on for a very long time. So that makes choosing easier. You just look for the latest one. But even in the nonfiction side, I mean, the examples I brought are all some of my nonfiction favorite authors, and each of them have written a range of books. If I had to pick one book or one author, which maybe is preempting a question you would ask later, it would be, you know, a book that had probably the most profound impact on me and the way I think about the world is by an author called Muhammad Yunus, who wrote, his first book was Banker to the Poor, which was about the microcredit revolution in Bangladesh and how the classical economics he was taught at Harvard, you know, did not seem to work when he went back to poverty-stricken Bangladesh. And he spent time in communities trying to figure out why that was and sort of, if you like, redeveloped economics for that local environment, including the development of microcredit and the economic revolution that transpired in Bangladesh through the formation of the Grameen Bank and all of the other offshoot businesses. It's not so much the credit that interested me, but the way he understood what was keeping people in poverty and how to overcome that and how and the faith in the human spirit that he showed when he helped people start little businesses and emancipate themselves once you could figure out what was keeping them in the poverty trap. But it really just opened my eyes to thinking about things, you know, the world and inequality and those kind of things in a different kind of way.
Has that have influenced your work in social determinants of health and that kind
of thing? Yeah. So, you know, we often look, I mean, as much as Insight is in other lines of business, now my background is healthcare. And, you know, we often get, from an actuarial point of view, we get, you know, taught the health insurance principles and, you know, risk pooling and risk stratification and risk adjustment and solvency and all of those kind of things. But the bigger picture of health and the much bigger driver of health is, you know, the so-called social determinants, which is a massive issue in South Africa where we have such high levels of poverty. So can't expect people to be healthy when they barely have enough food to eat, they don't have housing security, they don't have job security, and those kinds of things. So it's just, yeah, it's, I think it's important to understand the broader context of the environment you're working in.
Yeah. What do you think is the answer? What are the most obvious steps we can take to improve?
So when I give talks on social determinants of health, sometimes I get to that question and it comes in different ways. They would say, like, what if you were this or that minister or you're in charge of it? So, and that's what I like about Yunus's approach. So Banker to the Poor was his first book, and then there were a few others, including this one, which is about building social business. So he doesn't believe in the very narrowly defined view of capitalism that profit is the only incentive, that there are other incentives that drive people to succeed and grow and invest their time and effort. And I think with a loose definition, social entrepreneurship is the right way to think about it. You need many more thousands of micro businesses that are well constructed with maybe some startup funding, but that to release the you know, human ingenuity and human spirit for innovation and survival and for thriving. That's what you need to unlock that. So one way to do that would be to go into communities where there's high unemployment and get everybody, you know, in a town hall and say, okay, well, you know, what skills do you have? What can you do? This one can bake, this one can do carpentry, this one can do whatever, you know, and help them think about how to translate those skills from what would in South Africa be the informal labor market into micro businesses. And you can do that at scale. So, yeah. I mean, I don't want to say it's not difficult. I think it is difficult, but that would be the way I would approach the problem.
We know that you are a health actuary, and I guess we'll talk about your achievements in that field. But I'd like to know about your upbringing and your journey from, you know, your childhood, and then how you eventually become an actuary and a health actuary. And then I suppose we can talk about the Insight journey separately. But about you?
Actuarial science was a little bit of a, I don't want to say an accident, but someone told me once I went to sort of a traditional Model C West Rand Johannesburg school where they typically produce plumbers and electricians, not actuaries. But I didn't know what I wanted to do after school. Career guidance was quite a loose description of, you know, what they did for us there. There was no ad maths program or anything like that, you know, that you find in some other schools. So went to university basically as a continuation of school, not knowing exactly what I wanted to do. So I did physics, chemistry, biology, and math in first year, sort of majors across the board just to see, you know, what happened, what would stick, what would be interesting. And through the math stream got exposed, I mean, through the different, each of the different subjects got exposed to, you know, engineers over here and medical students over there. And on the math side, got exposed to some of the engineers, actuarial science people and accounting. And I mean, there was enough time to go and, you know, hop in and drop in other lectures. And yeah, I think it stuck, you know. There were some confluences of events that sort of nudged me in that direction. Yeah, that's eventually how I did actuarial science. I would say I was an academic underdog there, at least at varsity. I mean, by the time I got to honors, you know, the guys that were still there doing honors, because the attrition rate is high, as you know. Yeah, definitely an underdog. But, you know, I think with, you know, grit and compensating hard work for academic underdogness, you get there in the end. And then health was also incidental, I suppose. I'd done some vac work at varsity for a healthcare firm. When I got out of varsity, took whatever job was available, which was a year of pensions, which I didn't especially enjoy. And then the doctor that I'd done some vac work for called me about a year and a bit later to say they needed someone at then Liberty Health. Now, this is going back into 2002, so a long time ago. And yeah, that was my jump into healthcare, and I've been there ever since.
What's the next author we're going to talk about?
The next author, well, they're in no particular order. The next order would probably be Walter Deming.
Okay.
So he is he's commonly regarded as the father of quality improvement theory in the world. He is an operations research scientist, and his ideas were not well received in the United States. One of his books was called Out of the Crisis. There was a sort of manufacturing crisis, high cost and poor quality, for example, in the motor vehicle industry in the US, around the time he was developing these ideas, and these ideas were not well received. And he took them to Japan.
Okay.
And, you know, that was, he was, it's credited as being instrumental in the quality revolution in manufacturing in Japan, whether it's, you know, vehicles or electronics or whatever, because the way of thinking about quality and quality as a goal to strive for was a marketing benefit on its own, reduced costs, et cetera. And there were many benefits to that. But he then developed his ideas sort of philosophically into a way of thinking about business and systems and how to think about looking at systems, collecting data, understanding the variation in a system, not overly penalizing individuals in the system when variation is a function of the system, not the individual, or poor performance. We often call poor performance on an individual without understanding that it's a function of the system that they're in. And one of his quotes is that a bad system will beat a good person every time. So that started to help me think about, and it's one of the things I like about healthcare, as opposed to the other lines of financial services, is it's a whole system, integrated, complicated system with efficiencies and inefficiencies and dependencies and constraints and all of those kind of things. And so his work was some of the first work I read that helped me sort of shape the way I think about those kind of things.
How have you applied his thinking or his principles to?
I'm not like a direct application kind of guy. The way I think about those kinds of things are you read interesting ideas and they sort of go and sit in your subconscious, and then you read more, and that, you know, dots are joined and ideas sort of coalesce, and it just informs the way you think. I mean, like he was famous for having, I can't remember if it's 12 or 14 principles. So it's not like I have them stuck on the wall and I'm like, okay, well, this principle applies here and there. But certain of the ideas stick, and I think you tend to apply them more subliminally than specifically. So I'm not diligent like that. You could be, I suppose, but I'm not, you know, an evangelist for, you know, him or any other particular author. But just, I think the ideas, you know, resonate and then percolate and combine with other ideas to form the way you think about things.
So if you've, you know, probably subconsciously assimilated these ideas into your way of thinking and, you know, designing a business, how would you say you have designed Insight to reflect that?
So one thing we talk about quite a lot at Insight is constant improvement. So, you know, the story of practice makes perfect is actually not correct. So practice, the saying should be practice makes improvement. If you go for perfection all the time, you're going to get frustrated, and you can aim for that as a goal, but it's a bit like, sometimes it's an unattainable thing. You know, you can set a standard that's unattainable. What's a much better approach is to just strive for constantly improving. So we do that in a bunch of ways at Insight, you know, from a training point of view, from encouraging, I mean, there's training we provide at a group level, but we do a lot to encourage individuals to hone their own skills, give a lot of feedback internally to say, well, you know, this is an area for improvement, or you know, we a senior might be in a presentation that a more junior person is giving, and they'll give them feedback. So we have a lot of mechanisms for internal feedback, and with an emphasis on improvement. That comes with some challenges, which is, you know, if you have a sort of constant improvement mindset, you tend to focus on the things that need improvement, as opposed to, you mustn't fall into the trap of, you know, not celebrating the things that are also fantastic. So it's a little bit of a balance there, but definitely that one of the ideas of, you know, an improvement mindset, an improvement cycle, and improvement science, and feedback in the group, and making sure you get feedback from all levels of people in the firm is super important. It's not a top down kind of approach. You need feedback from everybody.
10 years of insight. What would you say are some of the leadership lessons you've learned? You know, things that have worked well, or you know, mistakes you've made.
Yeah, many, lots of mistakes along the way. But you know, overall, I think we've been incredibly successful and lucky, which is an important, also learning from one of the other authors, is that, you know, I think it's a mistake to attribute all of your success to just your own hard work. There's an enormous amount of luck involved, and it's important to give credit for that. I think believing in people is a big part of our success. You know, we try to find the right people. We get it right most of the time, not all the time. Choosing the right people is very hard. But at the end of the day, as much as we also sell services and platforms and other things, a large part of the work is still consulting, and that is a very people-oriented business. And so it's been an enormous joy. It's given me the highest highs over the last 10 years, you know, working with amazing people and seeing people grow and seeing people develop and, you know, grow into their potential. That's probably my favorite thing. Of course, like I say, you don't get it right all the time. So that comes with some bumps and, you know, mistakes, and, you know, some people don't fit, and they, you know, they have to then find their success in other places. But yeah, I think that's probably been the most interesting part of the ride for me. And also what I struggled with early on was, you know, that it, for some people it is a stop along their way, you know, and that in the early days I used to really struggle if someone left. I was like, why would you leave? Like, you know, this is such a wonderful place to work, and we've created this wonderful environment where people can be their best selves and do their best work. And for some people, it's a stop along their way, for whichever reason, you can take a karmic view of that, and they needed it in their pathway, you know, that might benefit all of us, you know, in the fullness of time. But not all books are long books. Some are short, you know, some chapters are long and some are short, and that's fine.
So if you are in an interview with someone, or you're interviewing someone for a position, you know, are there ways to know if they'll be a good fit or not? Is it gut?
It's hard. I mean, it's the subtle ones that are difficult to pick up. The obvious ones you try to screen out, you know, early on. You need a certain aptitude. You need a certain disposition. Consulting comes with its own challenges, as opposed to being in a corporate, you know, where you're doing back office valuations or something. So you look for certain traits there. But actually, you know, if you were to look at our people, our sort of 100 or so people, the range of people and personality traits and characteristics is extraordinarily broad, which also tells a story that it's very difficult actually to say. I mean, some of my best hires, like, I had to have a second pass at, because I looked over them the first time because they just didn't sort of resonate initially. And you know, when I went back, then a little bit of extra information came out that didn't come out in the first interview. But, you know, some of those people have been with me for over 10 years and have been extraordinary. So it's very hard, actually. You know, you have to get a gut feel for it, and, you know, just be okay with having a good enough batting average. You're not going to get it right 100% of the time, but if you're getting it right 80% of the time, that's okay. An interview, or like asking someone to do a little bit of work, or it's very difficult to tease out. And, you know, sometimes problems may only emerge 18 months or 2 years later. So, you know, you're never going to pick that up in an interview or looking at a CV. So you have to be okay with that. But like I say, overall, you try to, you know, you just want a high enough batting average that I'm reminded of that Roger Federer quote where he speaks about, you know, he only won 50-something% of all the points he's played. But, it's, you know, overall, it still adds up to the right thing.
Who is the next author we're going to talk about?
So the next author would be, that's a little bit of a cliche, is the Nicholas Taleb books. So I actually prefer his first book, is my favorite of his, called Fooled by Randomness. I read that quite early on in my actuarial career. I think it should be required reading for actuaries. It's a little cliche because I think a lot of actuaries would appreciate his work because it's
Yeah,
sort of,
it's probably been the most popular book on the podcast.
I mean, I found Fooled by Randomness the most, like, he introduces really nice concepts there, and he was much less arrogant in the way that he wrote, and also more succinct. Like his later books, I think each new book got longer and more verbose and difficult to penetrate, or to get through his style of writing. But yeah, I think he's got some really great concepts, and there he talks about, one of the things I remember from his writing, when you ask people, what's contributed to their success, and if they don't include luck in there, then they don't understand survivorship bias and those other kind of concepts, which I think are some key elements in his work are, like, really help you look at the world in a particular thing. Like survivorship bias, I think, is one of the most important business concepts that is overlooked. You look at successful businesses now and try to emulate them without understanding what their starting circumstances were 10 years ago, 20 years ago. What you really need to understand is all the businesses that tried that, how many succeeded, how many failed, because you don't see the failures because they don't exist anymore. So those kind of concepts, I think, are foundational to the way you think about things.
And what about his other books?
His other books are good. I mean, Black Swan and Anti-Fragile and Skin in the Game is probably my next favorite. I think there's some nice, I think, because of the, and that touches on one of the other authors, because it's about how you behave, and you behave differently when you have skin in the game and you don't, and your incentives are different and your risk appetite is different and those kind of things. So that's probably my next favorite.
Do you have quotes from these books?
There's a nice Walter Deming quote, which I like, which is, I mentioned earlier, the bad system will beat a good person. But he has another one, which I really like, is that evolution is not necessary, or adaption is not necessary, because survival is not mandatory. And what he's saying there is, you don't have to change with the times and evolve and grow, but nor do you have to survive, And what he's really saying is that in order to survive and thrive, you need to improve and evolve and grow.
What would you say is your favorite cognitive bias, or the one that you find most fascinating?
There's probably two. I think hyperbolic discounting is a key one, because it's so, I think it's the main driver behind our inability to sort out our health. So the hyperbolic discounting is, you discount future benefits much more sharply than we should, much more heavily than we should. So in financial terms, that would mean that the way we discount future financial gains is much heavier than exponential curve, normal compound interest. We discount the future hyperbolically, which is much steeper. So we put much more weight on current things than on future things. So that has all sorts of implications. For, colloquially, it would be the instant generation. That would be what we were talking about. You want everything now. So the inst getting instant satisfaction, like not trading off, I'm going to eat this meal now, I'm going to eat this bad food now, and it's going to have a long-term consequences. And there's a cumulative effect of that. And on the exercise side, it's, oh, I've got to ex like go through the, and I don't enjoy doing this exercise now, but the benefit is in the long term. Now, if you've ever had to watch your weight, which I've had to do and still continue to do as I get older, it's almost like, changes are a little bit. It's not like all of a sudden you get on the scale and you've picked up 20 kilograms. It happens a little bit by little bit. But then when you realize it's too late now, and that's happened over a long period of time. And it's part of this, because we don't think about time effectively in our brains. We don't make those short-term and long-term trade-offs properly. The people that do are people that tend to have very good self-discipline, and they understand, and they're able to make that trade-off effectively, and tend to have better eating and exercise habits. The other one is anchoring, which I found fascinating, that you can anchor. Even the interesting thing about anchoring, which is that if you prime somebody, let's say if you're selling your house, you prime them for a particular value ahead of, like, if you're asking estate agents for the typical example, if you're asking estate agents for, to value a house, if you do it without prompting, they'll come up with a certain value. If you do it making a certain suggestion, the results will anchor around that suggestion, higher or lower. And even if they know it's happening, and even if it's extreme, even if it's unreasonable, it has an effect. And what I like about that, which is the other author, Dan Ariely, which really is like a pop introduction to, as much as he's written scientific stuff, the books are like pop culture, behavioral science. What I find fascinating about that is we were taught in economics about, the rational mind, and you make these trade-offs and portfolio theory and math, and it's nonsense that people just don't make decisions like that. On a day-to-day basis, big decisions, small decisions, we're affected by all manner of things. Some subliminal, I mean, that's why marketing is a thing, So yeah, I love that understanding, at least that, we're not always rational. I mean, yeah, classical economics is reducing human decision making to tractable math because you can't do it any other way, to try to get the math right. But
Yeah.
actually, behavior doesn't work like that at all.
Do you think one can kind of overcome one's
Yeah, I think
biases?
having a like any problem or bias, as it were, it's being aware of it is the first step, and then actively working on it. So putting your own discipline mechanisms in place, whether it's finances or exercise or eating or even working on a sort of unconscious bias that's become a problem for you that you need to work on. Being aware of it is the first thing, and recognizing it, okay, I need to work on this thing, and then putting mental steps in place, gates, if you like, to say, well, okay, and instead of this idea just shooting out of my mouth, let me think about it first and put it through these other filters. And then I think you can improve, definitely.
I struggle with I guess the extreme of being disciplined and having long-term views and exchanging short-term satisfaction for long-term benefits. Do you start to associate if it's bad or if it's difficult and if it's making me unhappy, it must be good for me? And then
No, I don't know.
conversely,
No, I
if
don't
I'm
know. But I
enjoying
think
it,
it
it must be
can. I think
bad.
it, for some people. I mean,
Yeah.
I thought it's become very clear to me as I've sort of thought about this more and spoken to more people about this, is we are all wired very differently. For some people, that kind of discipline, I mean, it's an obvious point, I suppose, but for some people, that kind of self-discipline is automatic. And for other people, it's like a massive amount of conscious effort to try to impose any kind of discipline and structure on their day-to-day life. I mean, I would think that would be unhealthy if you started to associate with difficult, painful things as being good for you in the long run. I don't, that's a, that that would be a bad generalization.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I'll seek help for that. Who's the next author we're going to talk about?
So one more non-fiction author is Eli Goldratt. He wrote a book called The Goal, and The Goal is also about systems. So this turns out to be a theme that I'm interested in, which is understanding systems and people and how they interact and how to optimize and how to, I mean, I don't know whether one author led on to another, but these are the things that I find interesting to think about and read about. So yeah, he wrote this book called The Goal, which introduced me to this idea of the theory of constraints, which is also about optimization and about understanding bottlenecks in a system and a process, and where to apply effort to improve a system or an organization. And it has to be around the bottlenecks. Also understanding dependencies and processes that have dependencies tend to diverge. Anyway, I mean, it's all a little obscure, but these are the kind of thing, like not direct application. But what I've often found is, many of these ideas, you'd be presented with a problem in work, in your business, in the healthcare system, or wherever you operate, and there'll be this idea that kind of like it resonates, the problem resonates with something you've read, in these things, and then you think, ah, but this is why this is happening, because there's the system is structured like this, and therefore this is what you would naturally expect. So yeah, that's where I first came across the idea of, effort for improvement should be at bottlenecks. Otherwise, you're just wasting your time. Any effort to improve a system or a process that's not a bottleneck is a waste of effort. And then understanding the bottlenecks, understanding, well, should we be doing this thing at all? Oftentimes, you try to optimize a process, but the first question should be, should we be doing this step in the process at all? Why, can't we just do without it? What happens if we take it out? Does the whole thing fall apart? So that's where I first came across that idea. And then he also, wrote some other books. But yeah, I mean, helped shape the way I think about, systems, people, optimization, those kind of things.
What would a typical example of a bottleneck in a consultancy be?
If you have like unnecessary bureaucratic processes of approval to do something,
Okay.
is send out a proposal, send out pieces of work, Now, of course, you need some kind of hierarchy, bureaucracy, you need to maintain quality control, etc. But if those are artificial and or unnecessary, they just slow things down. And when you slow things down, bottlenecks cause friction, they cause frustration, they cause inefficiency. So you have to think about, you know, what is a way to address that problem. Allocating work, operations, marketing, content generation, you could apply it in any, you know, part of the business. Think about things in that kind of way.
What you've been speaking about probably relates to this next question, but if you weren't an actuary, what do you think you would be doing?
Yeah, I almost certainly would have done engineering of some sort, and probably industrial engineering.
Okay.
You know, thinks about, you know, processes and systems and dependencies and how to structure a system so that it works efficiently and that sort of thing.
As an actor, you're probably best known for your work during COVID and, you know, representing us as healthcare committee or leading it. What was it like to be in that position at that time?
It was a very wild 2 years. I mean, I can honestly, hand on heart, say I've never worked so hard, including, you know, starting a consultancy from scratch or even at big corporate, you know, trying to make a career. During COVID, it was that and a whole other full-time job almost, dealing with the various business entities and academic institutions and some limited involvement in chatting to government about getting the public and private sectors to work together more effectively. But yeah, there was, because I mean, we weren't in tourism, right? So the insight carried on. In fact, you know, the demand for our work increased notably during the period. So everybody worked hard. And then on top of that, there was just all of this other actuarial work, you know, for trying to get some reasonable outputs out of a working group, an ESSA working group, plus like I say, interacting with various of these other entities. There were many, many early morning calls and late night calls and stuff like that. I have no regrets. It was a phenomenal growth experience for me and an opportunity, I think, to give back to the profession, because that was all professional work, if I could put it that way, you know, not commercial work. But it was a very busy time.
What was the main output, the COVID, the model?
There were models. The model is really just a means of thinking about things. And in the end, turned out not to be the main product. I mean, I think we were looked to assimilate research and to, you know, help people think about the risks, think about the problems, what to be careful of. There were many mistakes along the way. And again, it comes to this idea of, you know, in the face of uncertainty, you need to constantly reflect and improve all the time. You need to be able to assimilate new information, including conflicting information, make judgment calls, but then learn along the way. The difficulty is, from a policy point of view, sometimes you can be quick to make a decision based on available evidence. But then when new evidence emerges, it's difficult to undo that decision, but neither can you do nothing. So this is the difficulty that many governments faced. They couldn't do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Some overcompensated, some, you know, some undercompensated. So there, yeah, it was very difficult, very complex time.
In retrospect or in hindsight, and it all feels so long ago now, but how do you think, you know, in terms of COVID, how has your thinking changed from, you know, when you were in the thick of it? Were there any aspects that changed for you?
I mean, the really tricky part was there were strong calls to shout louder as ESSA, as an organization, and to, you know, be more influential and, you know, have stronger views and those kind of things. And I must say, I tried very hard not to be that person, that we could be in the room and be a advisor and counselor to, you know, some people that were thinking about these things, the bigger decision makers. But I was very wary of wanting to come across as, you know, a society or an organization even that had all the answers, when many other people were claiming that they had all the answers, and actually there was an enormous amount of uncertainty. I think what I'm most proud about is managing to retain nuance in the discourse, which I was very sad that many people lost, including the society. The actuarial society went through significant strain within the profession, within the group, because it became an extremely polarizing point of argument. And much like the tribalism in some of the other parts of the world, this political party or that political party or this view or that view. And, you know, we seem to have lost the ability to agree with people on some things and disagree with them on other things. Because if I disagree with you on this, then I disagree with you entirely, which can't be the case. And you get these clusters of things. If you tell me what your view is on some or other controversial topic, I'll almost certainly be able to tell you what your view is on all of these other things that are completely unrelated. And it shouldn't be like that. You know, we should be able to, you know, evaluate each thing on its merits without this sort of tribalism there. But it was very sad. And, you know, I think some people were frustrated that, you know, we didn't, you know, claim a more prominent place on the stage in terms of advising government or business or whatever. But I actually think we were I was happy with our sweet spot there. I wouldn't change that in retrospect.
And obviously the next big thing for healthcare actuaries will be NHI.
Mm.
I feel since, you know, a flurry of activity a few months ago, it's been quiet, at least, you know, from the outside. What's it been like behind the scenes?
There's an enormous amount behind the scenes. And again, it's a similarly complex topic where we've seemed to have lost the ability to talk with nuance. You can't criticize NHI for fear of, you know, being put in the anti-poor camp, you know, or anti-government. You can't criticize any aspect of it, let me say. I mean, there are things of NHI policy, I think, that are great, and some things I think that are going to be what I would characterize as the path of most resistance as opposed to the path of least resistance, and I think will be very difficult to implement if they're implementable at all. But, you know, it's difficult to convey that in a nuanced kind of way. But no, there's an enormous amount of activity there. Unfortunately, that's on the legal front. So there are two active court cases and about three or four more that will manifest over the next few months. And I think, you know, both the applicants and the government in those court cases are going to be tied up for quite some time in dealing with those cases.
Are actuaries involved in those court cases?
Not especially, no. So again, it's a similar kind of thing there. I mean, there are actuaries involved in some of the institutions that are involved in some of the court cases. But no, I don't think they're not to my knowledge.
Who's the last author we're going to talk about?
So the last one is also a bit cliche for actuaries, I think, and it's a fiction author. If I had to pick one fiction author that I could only read his books forever after, it would probably be Terry Pratchett, just because he's got all the mix of the right things in there. You know, a bit of, I suppose, sci-fi fantasy. I don't have here.
You don't have one. I have one in my office.
Yeah, and he's I think he's extraordinary. Not as you know, epic tome as Tolkien or C.S. Lewis or those kind of, you know, would be some of my other favorites in the fantasy genre. But, you know, it's a beautiful thing to be laughing out loud when you're reading. And his wit and his understanding also of human nature. A great fiction author in whatever genre is teasing out some element of human nature that, you know, and focusing on that, sometimes making a caricature of it, whether it's a spy novel or a detective novel or a murder mystery or fantasy or sci-fi, whatever. I mean, there are many others. But what I like about Terry Pratchett's writing is there's a social commentary element, there's satire, there's humor, and also that there's a lot of them. So there's 40-something books, and you read them and you can read them in different orders. And there's really rich characters that he develops over time. And I enjoy the way that he writes. So I've always got a smile on my face when I'm reading.
Not so much about the plot and the, you know, the magical element of it.
No. So that's really just his medium.
Yeah.
I mean, again, the good authors are, they use whatever the genre is as the medium to communicate whatever they're communicating. But he's a master at that, I think. That stuff is very much in the background, and it's not the star. The genre is not the star, but the characters that he develops and the stories that he tells are the star.
Are there any books that stand out for you in the series or in his universe?
I mean, some of the storylines, again, you know, there's a series in each of the storylines. So I particularly like the equal rights storyline, which is the sort of the witches. I like the, I didn't especially like his vampire storyline. I liked the storyline of the death character, which is another nice storyline. But I think one of my favorite subgenres, if I can say, in his books are his satirical writings on government institutions like banks and the post office and various other things like that. So he writes on the, like he almost it pokes enormous fun at these bureaucratic institutions and the way that they operate and the implications of the way they operate. But yeah, just in a masterful kind of way.
When did you get into Terry Pratchett?
I would say in the early 2000s. And I'd read a few, but they were my first sort of long-running series of audiobooks.
So you listened to them.
Yeah. Which were great, because if you have a good narrator on audiobook, it also just adds a whole other dimension to the experience.
Who narrates Terry Pratchett?
I think you can find with a couple of different narrators. I'm not good for remembering the names of the narrators. But yeah, I mean, I would probably say I've listened to more books than read physically, just because of the time in traffic and traveling and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So John Le Carré you can just line up the series.
Yeah.
And just keep listening.
Where do you see the actuarial profession going in, say, the next 10 years?
I mean, there's been some concern about data science and the like encroaching in our territory, but I don't think that's right. I think the technical skills are interesting in the data science world, and I think it's the actuary's job to think about what are the best skills available that can help us do our job better. But I don't think there's anybody really that can do our job the way we do, including AI, by the way. It might help us do it better, but I think the ability to ask the kinds of questions that we ask, I think, is quite unique. And the training that we have, I think, is quite unique. Thinking about risk, thinking about things in the long term, thinking about different stakeholders, the professional element, the professionalism element, which, you know, is not part of being a statistician or a data scientist or whatever, but understanding that there's a, you know, we have a professional code of conduct, like lawyers and doctors and these other things, and there's an obligation and acting in the public interest and all these other rich layers that sit on top of the technical skill, which is often what people focus on. But actually that our job is to sort of manage that delicate balance between the different stakeholders, policyholders, shareholders, policymakers, as I say, the public interest, and try to allow. And then all of the math that goes into doing that is a very unique combination of skills. So I think we'll continue to find new areas where we can apply those skills. But in the areas where we apply them, I think I really am not worried about the threat of any kind of emerging technology. I just think it'll help us do the job better and deeper and richer. I probably wouldn't have been an actuary if it wasn't for Excel. I can't see myself doing the calculations on log tables and things like that. So I think it actually having better tools that you can, you know, Python and all of these other kind of programming languages, I think just help do the job better and richer and deeper and finer grained and get better answers. But I think the training is invaluable. I mean, I think locally there's been good work on transformation and that needs to continue. I think if we could do more, it would be to reach down further to help people up. So, I mean, there's a longstanding challenge in the quality of math education in South Africa, which is a key input for the actuarial profession. And the society does a lot, but I think the profession more broadly could do a lot. Like, we're dabbling with a chess program now, chess in schools, partly because of the success of the chess competition as a convention. But as a longstanding idea that we've had because of the, I was going to say correlation, but the causative effect of improved academic results if a school has a chess program. So that's just one example.
Is that a thing?
Absolutely, 100%.
Okay.
So that's just one example, but I think, you know, there's a lot of heavy lifting to do on our education system. And I think, you know, the actuarial profession could do a lot. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition for the future success of the actuarial profession that, you know, basic and secondary and tertiary education, technical education is significantly improved.
I wanted to touch on something, you know, we were talking about actuarial skills and, you know, the various aspects of being an actuary. And with all our various practice areas, which diverge quite a lot, do you think there is still a lot of, you know, core actuarial skills that they all have in common?
I think the themes are similar. The applications are different. So, you know, solvency is a thing. Risk is a thing. Understanding variation is a thing. And again, the professional themes of, you know, customer or policyholder protection and those kind of things. So I think the themes are very similar. The math is different and the applications are different, and there's always a bit of an arm wrestle about, you know, who's a proper actuary, life actuaries, health actuaries, you know.
Do you think the personalities are different?
I think so. I think there is a bit of a selection effect. So, you know, you tend to be drawn where there's some kind of resonance. So I think there are some, there's some selection effects that play out in personality types, yeah.
Good. Well, let's let's recap the authors we've spoken about today. So we spoke about Muhammad Yunus, Walter Deming, Nicholas Taleb. We mentioned Dan Ariely, Ellie Goldratt, and Terry Pratchett. And I know you mentioned at the beginning which one you take with to a desert island, but what's your final answer?
Is it a book or can I take a few?
You can take
books?
A few
of the books. I mean, I'd probably go with Terry Pratchett.
Good choice.
Just because, you know, you got everything to be miserable about. May as well, you know, read some books that make you laugh and smile.
Do you reread books?
Sometimes, yeah.
Okay.
Not often, because again, like the unread pile is enormous. So it feels like I'm cheating the unread books if I'm going back to one I've already read.
Yeah.
But sometimes.
What are you currently reading?
Currently, I'm making my way through one of the Robert Galbraith books.
All right.
And I'm listening to one of the Wheel of Time books. It's a fantasy series.
Okay.
That they made into a TV series, and now I'm making sure that I have the story down. Yeah.
Okay.
I had that one. I'd done some of the books, but not the full series. And so now I'm trying to make my way through the whole series. And also, Ascent of Man, which is like a book written by a BBC documentary scientist. It's more of an anthropological book, actually. That's a little bit about, you know, how we got to where we got.
The Stench of Man.
Okay. Yeah, so it's about human development, basically, from an anthropological and scientific point of view. So, and what just an interesting little tidbit there, which I found fascinating was, and it resonates with all the same themes we've been talking about, even though it's a completely different book, but it gives you like a framework to think about things. So, you know, evolutionary development is a particular pathway that took place over, you know, an extraordinary long period of time, but cultural evolution was much faster. And the reason for that was that they were able to disseminate and pass on information much better. So if you think about it from an evolutionary point of view, it has to happen genetically, which is in sequence, across a wide frontier in parallel over long periods of time, whereas cultural evolution can happen much faster and in parallel rather than in series, and you don't lose the information. So again, from an organizational point of view, that immediately makes you think about, okay, well, what are the bottlenecks to improving? And you can identify two. The first one is the ability to learn as an individual, as an organization. That becomes a bottleneck to growth if that is too low. And the ability to disseminate information across the organization, which is another bottleneck, which will inhibit growth and improvement.
Okay.
So if you can fix those two things, or open the taps on those two things, then it sets you up for faster growth and development. So that's the kind of an example of how the ideas sort of coalesce into something interesting, and then you think about that from a business or personal development point of view.
Can that kind of go both ways, or go negatively as well, if the wrong or undesirable culture gets disseminated more quickly? Do you have any control over that?
Yeah. Culture is a tricky thing. So your culture sort of does have a life of its own, but I think you don't want to leave it entirely unshepherded. You need to let it evolve within an organization, but I think you do want to set, you know, boundaries and principles within which that happens, so that it can grow in a healthy kind of way rather than unhealthy kind of way. But that comes back to the earlier point about people again. You know, it's you can have if you happen to have a bad egg in an omelet, like it can ruin the whole thing. So it's tricky to get that right, and you have to try to solve those problems as early as you can. But I think paying attention to culture and being, you know, as deliberate about it as you can be, without trying to over curate it, because it will often cause harm, I think is that's the way we try and do it. But it's tricky. It's hard.
So just before we go, I have a gift for you to say thank you for being on the podcast. I don't know if you've read this book before.
Well, let's see.
So it's called Invisible Woman by Caroline Criado Perez.
No, I haven't read that. Amazing.
And
thank you.
It combines some of my personal interests, which are, you know, feminism, and I guess there's a bit of stats and human behavior science. Yes. Yeah.
Brilliant.
And it talks about how half the population has, you know, been excluded from research and data, and how that can have very real consequences. So, yeah, I hope you enjoy it. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts when you get around to reading it.
100%. Thank you so much. It actually reminds me of another book I read, which I think was called, what is it called? Half of the Sky, which is...
Oh, yes, I think similar, you mentioned it to me.
Yeah, it's also a similar point about, I mean, women in particular, but many parts of society that have been marginalized historically, and just never mind all of the ethical and moral problems with that, but also what a waste. Like, just to not manage to unleash all of that potential, aside from all of the, on top of all of the moral and ethical problems. But okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I look forward. Last two questions. Where can people get hold of you, follow your insights journey?
All over. I'm on LinkedIn or email at barryc@insight.co.za. But yeah, I'm online pretty much all the time, or a lot of the time.
Insight social media pages.
Or the Insight social media pages.
And what message for 2025 would you like to share with our listeners?
I would say my 2025 message would be to be bold. You know, don't be afraid of what might have held you back in the past. You know, be bold. I don't want to say take risks. People, you know, that may be the wrong way to characterize it. But, you know, don't be afraid. Step forward. Step out of your comfort zone. You know, take those steps towards what you want to achieve and just go ahead and do it.
Thank you so much, Barry.
It's an absolute pleasure. Okay.